Anyone here know Essie Dunbar? No? No one knows her? Anyone heard about her?
Is she in that movie about NASA that's on at the moment and all those women who helped with the maths?
Probably not. Probably not, because Essie Dunbar is famous for a particular reason. And it's also because she lived during the first half of last century. So that's probably a bit too early for NASA. But she had an interesting life. And at the top of the list would have to be the fact that Essie is one of the few people in the world who has had 2 funerals. Just think about that. Most people normally have 1 funeral, but she's had 2. Now, the story goes back to 1915, when Essie was 30 years old. She suffered an attack of epilepsy. After the fit, it looked like she'd passed away, and so she was examined by Dr. Briggs, who found no sign of life, so he declared her dead. The funeral was organised for the next day, and in particular that would give time for Essie's sister, who lived in a neighbouring town. She'd have enough time to be able to get there and to attend the funeral. Now, apparently it was quite a lengthy funeral. I don't know if the church ministers were waiting for Essie's sister to arrive or not, but the story goes that there were actually 3 sermons preached at her funeral. So 3 ministers there, each one giving a sermon. But when they get to sermon number 3, Essie's sister hadn't yet arrived. So the ministers decided to go ahead with the burial. The coffin was lowered into the grave and covered with dirt. And then a few minutes later, well, Essie's sister just happens to arrive, and she asks that she might be able to see her sister for the final time. So the ministers agreed to allow the grave to be opened. They removed the screws from the coffin, when all of a sudden Essie sat up smiling at her sister. And apparently the ministers, in a state of shock, all of them fell down into the grave, with one of them suffering broken ribs. The mourners, they fled in fear, thinking that they'd seen a ghost, and Essie lived for another 47 years before finally being laid to rest. Now, that's a bit of a story, that one. I think we'd have to say, in a situation like that, that, what do you think, 2 funerals are better than 1? Would you have to agree with that? I think so, because at least if you've got 2 funerals, it means the first one, well, you're still alive somehow. And I think that Lazarus would have to agree with that as well. He's got something a little bit in common with Essie. But let's recall the situation of Lazarus, one of Jesus' best friends. He gets sick. His sisters ask Jesus to heal him. Jesus deliberately delays for 2 days before going to Lazarus' hometown in Bethany, which means that Lazarus dies of his illness. And that brings us effectively up to our passage today, which begins in verse 38. And this verse tells us that Jesus, being deeply moved within himself, again came to the tomb. Now please think carefully about those words. The fact that Jesus was overcome with emotion again indicates that this was a second time when Jesus was emotional. Now, the first instance was when Jesus was still outside the village, when Mary had gone out to meet him. And that's recorded in verse 33. And that verse makes it clear that Jesus was deeply moved in his spirit and he was upset. And the word translated as deeply moved, it conveys the idea of a strong expression of air. We can sort of hear the air, can't we, when a person cries or gasps for breath. It indicates that Jesus was overcome with emotion. But the question is, why? Why would Jesus be so emotional on that occasion? And verse 33, it's actually quite clear on why Jesus was so emotional. It says, when Jesus saw Mary weeping and the Jews who had gone with her weeping, he became emotional. But the word when can also be translated as since or because. It often indicates a cause, a reason. Jesus became emotional out of compassion for the grief and sadness of Mary and the others around him who were crying at that point in time. And I wonder, has that ever happened to you before? When you've been in a situation where people are sad, perhaps at a funeral? Sometimes it's not necessarily our sense of loss that moves us to tears, but the sense of loss that we see in others. If we're sensitive to the loss of others, then we will weep with those who are weeping. And it's amazing to see Jesus, the Son of God himself here, shedding tears in sympathy with the grief of others. Now, last week we looked at the famous verse, Jesus wept, in verse 35. But it's interesting that the verb used of Jesus in that verse, when he weeps, is actually different from the word used for weeping elsewhere in this passage. The typical word in the original Greek for weeping, it focuses on the sound that's made when a person cries or wails. But when Jesus weeps in verse 35, the word focuses not on the noise that's made, but on the tears. Jesus shed tears is one way of translating it. You can almost hear the sound of his teardrops hitting the dusty ground. But we also need to pay attention to where Jesus wept. I think for most of us, the assumption is that Jesus arrived at Lazarus's tomb, he's overcome with emotion, and so therefore he shed tears in front of the tomb. But it seems to me that Jesus doesn't actually arrive at the tomb until verse 38. So the tears that Jesus shed in verse 35, they seem to have been shed while Jesus was still on his way from outside the village to the tomb. Jesus was overcome with emotion and he shed tears in sympathy with the grief of others. But as the crowd around him acknowledged, it was also an expression of how deeply Jesus loved his friend Lazarus. So when he finally arrives at the tomb, he's overcome with emotion again. It's the second time. The first time was the grief of the mourners that moved him. But this second time, in front of the tomb, it makes sense to conclude that Jesus was overcome with emotion at this particular moment in time because of the sadness of the reality of death. Now, if you've ever lost a loved one or a friend, you probably know a little bit about how Jesus must have been feeling at that moment in time when he was looking upon the tomb of his dearly departed friend. Death is a tragic event. It moves us deeply when a loved one has passed on. And it's amazing to see that even though Jesus knew that he was about to raise Lazarus from the dead, he still allowed himself to feel the awful reality of death. He allowed himself to feel the terrible sadness that goes together with death. And we should also notice too how the narrative here, in a sense, slows down and focuses on what Jesus observed when he arrived at the tomb. There was a cave and a stone was placed over the entrance. Verse 39, Jesus said, "Remove the stone." Martha responded, "Lord, it smells, for it's the fourth day." Now, some people say that the fourth day was significant in Jewish thinking because they believed that it was only after 3 days that the soul left the body. Now, I've done a little bit of research about that view, and I think it's become popular through a guy called Leon Morris, who was a well-known Australian scholar. And there are some Jewish views to that effect, that the soul didn't leave the body until after 3 days. But it seems like that's only one possibility, because other people thought, well, it might be after 7 days or a longer period of time. We don't really know, and it doesn't really tell us in the text here whether or not that is significant, except to say that after 4 days, obviously the body had already started to decay. And I think we can say that the basic idea held in common by the Jews at that period of time was that once the body looks like it's started to decay, well then we know and we can conclude that the person is dead. It was normally signalled by the face of the deceased starting to change colour. But overall, that view about 3 days before the soul leaves the body, I think if it were important, then it would be mentioned in the text here, but it isn't mentioned. All that we have is a connection made between the 4 days and the beginning of the decaying of Lazarus's body in the tomb. The smell of death signalled the decay of the body, thereby proving that Lazarus was dead. Now, has anyone here smelt the smell of death before? If you have, then you know it's quite distinctive and not very pleasant. Now, my worst encounter with the smell of death probably happened in my garage, actually. At my place, we don't use the garage much, and it often has rats that try to take up residence inside. Anyway, one day I went into the garage, probably hadn't been in for 2 or 3 weeks, something like that. Walked in, only to find a dead animal in full decay, collapsed on the floor. It was a cat. Not ours. But by the time I had found the cat, it had maggots all through it and not much of its internal organs left. The worst was it was my job to clean it up. With the horrible smell, the sight of maggots wiggling around, it really wasn't very pleasant. And friends, when we think about death, when we're realistic about it, death isn't nice. We like to sanitize it, don't we? We dress up the person who's dead, put them in a nice looking coffin. We end up burying the body or perhaps cremating it. But when you think about it, the process of human decay is actually quite horrible. Basically, to give you a short summary here of what happens, you start to turn green. Then you bloat up. Your skin starts to blister. And then you turn black and fluids ooze from your body and internal gases escape until finally, eventually, you fade away to dust with only your bones left behind to witness to who you once were. Sorry if that was a little bit confronting, but it's not nice to think about, is it? Looking at it scientifically, death truly is gory. And friends, I guess that's what Martha feared, the smell of death. But how Martha is described in verse 39 is also significant. Martha, the sister of, literally, the one who had finished, the one who had come to an end, the one who had deceased, with the focus on ceased. It suggests that Martha, like everyone else, thought that Lazarus's life was finished. He had come to, literally, a dead end. Why remove the stone? It's finished. He's starting to rot. He's dead. All that you'll do by opening up the tomb is just to release the terrible smell of rotting flesh. But Jesus said to Martha, "Haven't I said to you that if you believe, you will see the glory of God?" Jesus was reminding Martha of their earlier conversation, the one in which Jesus identified himself as being the resurrection and the life. Now, I'm not sure what Martha and the others might have been thinking, but Jesus repeated the command to remove the stone. And friends, as they were lifting the stone away, literally Jesus lifted his eyes to heaven and he prayed to God the Father. And he did that in order to show to the crowd around him the amazing unity that exists between the Father and the Son. God the Father always hears the prayers of God the Son, and he had sent the Son into the world in order to bring life to the dead. And so after praying, Jesus then shouted out with a loud voice, "Lazarus, come out!" And what happened? As we see in verse 44, Lazarus, who is only described in that particular verse initially as the one who was finished, you know, the deceased one, people thought he'd come to an end. Well, here we see the deceased one emerging from the tomb. And it's described in some detail for us here. The deceased one, bound. It's the first thing that was noticed. He's still bound up, bandaged. And then it focuses on his feet and his hands. And presumably because that's the order that these things registered in the onlookers' brains. Imagine the scene. Someone who's wrapped up head to toe in bandages who's trying to walk. Yeah? You get the scene here? You can see the feet behind the bandages, right? Trying to walk. So that's what they see first of all, the feet. And then he's also trying to, maybe, where's his hands? I don't know, try and get out of this thing, this cocoon. It's just too claustrophobic here. We can see the feet, they're trying to move without too much traction. He's trying to free his hands, a little bit like a chicken trying to hatch from its egg, perhaps. And as they look with shock at the scene emerging before their eyes, they move their attention up from his feet to his hands and then up to his face. And what do they see? His face is still covered up with a cloth. You get the distinct idea that Lazarus wasn't quite bolting out of the tomb. And he can't see where he's going. Yeah? It's probably a bit slow motion, I'd suggest here. Not only could he not move freely, but he couldn't see. But he's trying his best, I guess. So it finishes off our passage here today with Jesus saying the obvious, really. Unbind him and let him go. Now, friends, as we look at this miracle, what's the significance of it? What's the meaning of this miracle? And in particular, do you understand the significance of the sign? Because in John's Gospel, you need to recall, there are 8 miracles which are given altogether, right? Only 8 miracles out of the thousands of miracles that Jesus performed are recorded for us here in John's Gospel. Now, does anyone remember what number sign out of the 8 signs in John's Gospel is this one, the resurrection of Lazarus? Number 7. Yes, strategically. We know in the Bible that number 7 is a significant number. What we see effectively, basically, as we look at the signs in John's Gospel, is that we see Jesus moving from small to big. It's one of the things that God does in this world, you know, moves from small to big. And sometimes he takes his time to do so. What do we have? Well, we've got the water, which was changed into wine. Remember that one? After that, it was followed by the long-distance healing of the royal official's son, the healing of the crippled man at the pool, the feeding of the 5,000, walking on water, giving sight to the man born blind, and then to top them all, we've got the resurrection of Lazarus. The greatest miracle performed by Jesus, apart from the resurrection of Jesus himself. So we've got 8 signs altogether in John's Gospel, but what does this sign number 7 signify? What does it tell us about Jesus? What do you reckon? I think it's pretty obvious, isn't it? Jesus is the resurrection and the life. Jesus already told us that before he performs that miracle. Now, friends, the expectation is, sadly, that one day the decaying corpse that's in the coffin, it's going to be you. And I assume that there's a coffin out there somewhere that's probably reserved for me too. One day, if we follow our ancestors to the grave, that stinking heap of rotting flesh is going to be us. Now, it's not nice to think about. But as followers of Jesus, we have a wonderful hope. We're not just going to stay there as a rotting heap of flesh. Our hope is that as Jesus indicated to Martha, if we believe, then that stinking heap of rotting flesh that disappears into dust will one day witness the glory of God. On the day of resurrection, when Jesus Christ returns, all who are in the graves will hear his voice and emerge from their graves. Those who have done good to the resurrection of eternal life, says Jesus, and those who have done evil to the resurrection of condemnation. We need to keep that in mind. We need to realize the significance of this sign and make sure that it's in our hearts. This sign needs to affect how we view the world, how we view our life here on earth, and what our ultimate destiny is. The Bible tells us if we believe in Jesus, then on the day when we are resurrected, with our own newly transformed eyes, we will behold the glory of God. That's the hope that Jesus gives us. That's the hope that is signified for us in the resurrection of Lazarus. Do you see the difference that Jesus makes? It's a massive difference. A rotting body compared to a body full of life. Jesus is the resurrection and the life. Because of him, death has been defeated.